Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and we are back for another two-hour Zero Point radio show. I invite listeners to check out my website at www.zeropoint.ca, and have a variety of writings and political and social commentary up there, and a number of reviews of different articles and books and so on. So please visit the website at zeropoint.ca. The main focus of this show is on explorations of mystical and spiritual teachings and their relationship to modern ideas in psychology and science. I'm attempting to elaborate an alternative model of the nature of human existence, and this is based upon this concept of zero points, that human beings actually have some point source or zero point center. And this is tied into the higher dimensional physics of the human heart. The concept is that we all have such a center, an individual I, at the heart of our own being. And somehow consciousness emerges from a zero point source, and it spreads all through the body, through the blood. And the soul life is connected to the breath. So I explore different esoteric religious teachings and try to develop a science of the soul and the model of how we could have multidimensional existence. My perspective, that zero point center, is then clothed in different bodies which form around zero point center, such that we then exist within different planes of being. But in the physical form, our consciousness is most connected into physical nature. But even after death, we still exist within our astral and mental bodies, although the circumstance and surroundings of our life will change. But we have continued existence beyond the material body. I would argue that consciousness, even when we're in the body, is never based upon or dependent upon material processes to produce consciousness. Instead, consciousness has some higher dimensional nature, and the individual self somehow comes into or inhabits the material body. So when the material body dies, you still have continuing existence in your astral body or your mental body, even on higher dimensional planes, on supramental planes. Hi, it's Christopher Holmes again, and we were just having a little bit of problem. We were being digitalized, and now we're going to be analyzed, and we're back on air, and I hope the sound quality is okay. I was just trying to introduce the show, and I was talking about the concept of human beings as having zero-point centers. This is based on the study of Madame Blavatsky's secret doctrine, wherein she says, material points without extension are the materials by which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies. What this suggests is that living beings have a zero-point center. They have a material point without extension, meaning some center, a life center, that's so small, in a way it's beyond the level of perception from the physical plane. When I say a person has a zero-point center, in a way that zero-point center, it's not so much that it's a little element, but more it's a condition. The zero-point, in a way, it's useful to conceive of a human being as having a threefold nature, body, soul, and spirit. Well, spirit is the realm of intelligence, spiritual intelligence or divine intelligence. But spirit has to ensoul the living organism. So the spiritual intelligence act, their influences are conveyed down into material reality and emerge from what we would judge to be a zero-point source. So the spiritual intelligences inform us from within without from zero points. So the influences of the gods and other invisible powers, they clothe themselves in bodies based on zero point centers. So the idea is each human being has, in a sense, a real I, like an individual real I. See, in modern times, people don't consider this concept. Instead, they believe a scientist, say, Francis Crick, who says, really, we're just a pack of neurons. Or Carl Sagan, we're just a bunch of, we're the results of what hydrogen can do, given enough time. And we're only a product of the neurons in the brain. And in that case, there would be no individual I. Instead, it's just billions and billions of different cells and neurons. And somehow together these constitute a living, conscious being. But I'm saying that's fundamentally mistaken. Instead, we truly do have an individual, unified element, an I, in a sense, and that is connected to the higher dimensional physics of the human heart. It's not only the human heart that has a higher dimensional physics to it. Everything in creation has a higher dimensional physics to it. In modern theories in physics, say the most advanced theory is called 11-dimensional KK supergravity theory. And it postulates that a human being, that any point within the four-dimensional space-time complex, the four large dimensions, is based upon a seven-dimensional Calabi-Yau space. So it's like at every point in four-dimensional space-time, there's a higher dimension, seven-dimensional element. This is called the Calabi-Yau element, or space. If you want to read about this, Brian Greene's book, and The Elegant Universe, is a good book explaining some of these concepts in science. So modern science itself has arrived at the notion that what appears manifest to us in four dimensions is really based on the physics involving a seven-dimensional hyperspace that underlies and sustains the familiar reality. Now, these new concepts in physics are, in many ways, clearly collaborate the type of ideas which Madame Blavatsky was articulating in The Secret Doctrine. Because Madame Blavatsky saw any living cosmos as having a zero-point center, and she saw that as having seven aspects to it. Really, she says the universe is founded upon seven zero-points. So it's like there's one zero-point, but then it becomes sevenfold. You might imagining this element differentiating from a central point and then being embodied in the Star of David, with a triangle turned upwards representing spirit and the triangle turned downwards representing water. So man has a spiritual and material aspect to our nature. And you put an element in the center of these two triangles, a point in the center of the Star of David, and that's the exalted form of that image or logos. And in a way, that Star of David with the central point can use to symbolize the higher dimensional nature of the human being. So anyway, through my work and studies, I explore the mysteries of human consciousness and trying to explain or understand how the ancient concepts about creation and the soul and so on, how can we understand these ideas within the modern scientific framework? Okay, so today I have a guest coming on at 4:30, and the lady's name is Pam, and I'm unfortunately do not even know Pam's last name. I was referred to her, or she was referred to me by someone who had heard her speaking on the program. And I kind of invited her on today, and what aspects I've heard a little bit of what she has to say, which is quite shocking to me, and I thought I'd invite her on today and hear what she has to say and try to give some kind of commentary or assessment on it. So I'm hoping that Pam is calling in on the half hour. So that gives me 15 minutes now. I'd like to introduce my co-host, James Moffat. Jim, how are you?
Oh, I'm well. How are you, Chris?
Okay. Good. Interesting times. I've been working. I've got a publisher for my new book called God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. I've been working through that again, doing some final edits, Jim.
Yeah.
And I heard back from the publisher. He said how timely the book was, and he said, and very, very well written, with an exclamation mark. So I'm really pleased that, you know, this book will hopefully come out in August. Before August 10th is the Theosophical Society, the International Theosophical Society meeting in Petaluma, California, at the IONS Center, which is the Institute of Noetic Sciences in California. I think they're having their conference in Florida the same week, Jim. IONS is.
Oh, IONS is having their conference.
Yeah,
like
that same week. They're away in Florida, and I'll be at IONS.
So is your book being published, that you say the publisher, is that through the Theosophical Society that this is being published, or is this something that they led you to, because I know they were helping you?
Yeah, they were helping. I think it's actually Point Loma Publications or www.wisdomtraditions.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.com.
Well, that's really exciting.
I'm so excited about it.
Yeah.
I really am.
It's very, very interesting to see what happens as a result of that, and, you know, to get your perspective out there in the more of the mainstream, and, you know.
Yeah, it's such an interesting book because this book has been through different revisions. It used to be called Divine Mysteries, and it was a collection of my writings on Blavatsky from the Within Without from Zero Point series, and I put all my Blavatsky segments into a separate volume. But it was never integrated as a whole, whereas in this new version of it, it's really integrated as a whole. And in a way, what I argue is that I'm trying to present a model of intelligent design. Like, we have this current issue of, like, creation versus evolution, or religion and science. And people argue over the idea of intelligent design. But in my survey of that debate, what I don't see is anyone who seems to be knowledgeable about what actual design elements are explained in mystical teachings. So I'm saying in The Secret Doctrine, it not only presents a model of intelligent design, but, I mean, that's what it does. It presents a model of intelligent design. It doesn't just say God created the universe or spiritual intelligence has created the universe. It actually gives us a higher dimensional model of the physics of how it's done. And the subtitle of the book is called Zero Point Metaphysics and the Holographic Space of Madame Blavatsky. And that's the idea, that we all have a zero point center. And that has a holographic, multidimensional nature to that holographic center. So it's making an effort to propose a serious alternative kind of metaphysical model of human existence. Jim? You see this in my work. I think you.
Yeah, and I've certainly been thinking about it more and more because I've been working on the problem of God's contracting universe, which is an overview of science versus religion debate and an exposition of the evolution of your theoretical position. And I see exactly what you say. Like, more and more, I've been reading a lot of the theoretical and historical commentary on the rise of modern science, and at the same time the conflicts between science and religion. And I see that, in a way, like to simplify things and say that, you know, it's science versus religion is really quite a like in Gurdjieff's terms, a formatory conceptualization of very complex matters. Like, it's much, much more complicated. It's not a question of science versus religion at all. There's a variety of different historical and theoretical and philosophical forces and perspectives that kind of weave through this whole debate, and it's much more complex than that. But getting to the essential...
Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost like that's a disinformation piece to cast the debate that it's religion or science, that it can't be both, it suggests.
Well, I think it's
one or the other, like it's our...
I think it's frequently polemical. I think people do cast it in that sense, and really sometimes out of ignorance, sometimes purposely to bolster their own position. And I mean, I'd say that on the side of both science and religion, that people have very kind of limited perspectives on things. But the more I kind of read about it, the more I kind of see how from your perspective in terms of intelligent design, as you say, like, if you're going to defend the idea of intelligent design, you have to go beyond just saying that, you know, that the evidence of the complexity of creation is evidence of design. And the question then becomes, what is the nature of that complexity? And science says, well, yeah, we have intelligent design. It's in the laws of nature. But even that's sort of a loaded term, too, as I mentioned on a previous program. David Ray Griffin, the theologian and philosopher, explores that whole question of, well, what exactly do we mean when we say scientific naturalism? And as he says, there are various interpretations of that position. Like, you can have the position of a Carl Sagan or a Richard Dawkins, which is that it's sensationistic, atheistic, and mechanistic naturalism. But as he points out, there are a variety of other opinions on that matter. And I would say that really what you're proposing is a naturalistic position. You're just saying that nature is much more complex and that it contains spiritual and religious elements to nature. Like, they're conscious elements, that they're ingrained in nature. And so we have to understand nature in a much more complex perspective and framework than science provides.
Yeah, exactly, because it's like Blavatsky in The Secret Doctrine. She is trying to explain the laws of nature. Like, she accepts a lot the existence of the laws of nature, but she's trying to explain the underlying metaphysical processes that lead to our familiar physics. So our familiar material world is based on, like, a higher-dimensional metaphysics. So Blavatsky says all the forces of nature are founded upon 7 zero-point dynamic centers, which step down the activity within the quantum vacuum and modify it to produce the laws of nature. Mm. So she has this kind of higher dimensional model of what the laws of nature, how they're actually produced out of a unified force. Similar to how physicists also are trying to show how all four forces of nature are really modifications of one fundamental force. Well, Blavatsky has the same argument, and there are many parallels between her teaching and the newest ideas in science.
Yeah.
So it's not just science or religion, but it's trying to look at the scientific basis of mystical teachings, or it's trying to look at the mystical dimensions of what we study in science. So it's kind of belying the false dichotomy that's been created between these.
Yeah, and then, you know, that also raises the whole question. If you look at Blavatsky's work or Gurdjieff or any of the profound esoteric and mystical teachings, you have to kind of ask yourself, well, how exactly did these people arrive at these determinations representations of the nature of reality, which are in many ways quite congruent with that which modern science has established, and yet in other ways, I think, are more comprehensive and go beyond what science has established. And that kind of brings up the whole question about the nature of knowing and how we can know. And that leads in turn to the idea that, well, those ideas are all esoteric and mystical ideas are based on the idea that consciousness is capable of being transformed and perfected. And that's the piece that's missing in the modern understanding of things on a variety of levels, so that once you have that perspective, you realize that there's a way of penetrating many of the mysteries that confront science, and that it involves developing consciousness and perfecting consciousness.
Yeah, perfecting ourselves as the observers.
Yeah.
And then if we shift our own in a more enlightened state of awakefulness and self-realization, we can have a different experience and apprehension of the nature of existence. So the idea that higher knowledge is kind of dependent upon us refining our consciousness and attaining to this more enlightened state, whereas usually people are so conditioned by the kind of mass hypnosis of modern society and no longer know themselves.
Yeah.
So knowing ourselves isn't knowing your personality and what your interests and hobbies and habits and so on, but really knowing yourself means awakening to this deeper self within yourself, that is, and that then could reveal a different understanding of the nature of reality.
Yeah.
It's like what you were saying too, Jim, like what led me in this direction was realizing all the enigmas in science. Like all the evidences for ghosts, out-of-body experiences, reincarnation memory, body fields, all the enigmas that most scientists close their eyes to and try to deny that there's anything to that or there's anything to that or there's anything to that. So they're all naysayers who try, but really all these enigmas, in a way, I took them as keys or clues that there had to be something deeper, and we need a deeper model of human existence to be able to explain all the enigmas. I see the scientists as fraud scientists because they close their eyes to all these things that doesn't fit into their materialist paradigm.
Right, and I think that, you know, I think that's really quite striking kind of jump to see all these things and say, well, what would we have to say about the nature of ourselves and the nature of consciousness to be able to incorporate all these anomalies and enigmas and facts and ideas that don't seem to fit with our current understanding of things? But on another level, too, it's even more basic to me than that, in the sense that really I don't see anything in materialist, reductionist, mechanistic science which explains the nature of life or the nature of consciousness. Like, there's always that gap between these material processes and the existence of life and consciousness. Like, to me, I just don't see that. Whereas if you invert things and you say, well, everything on some level is ultimately unified, and everything in the manifest world is in some way is derived from that fundamental unity, then it turns everything on its head, and then it's possible to see how life kind of descends from above or from out of the one, or however the one which is nothing which is one. You know, like you get kind of caught up in the difficulties linguistically of trying to explain the unexplainable, or something that's ineffable. But you know, in a sense, like, to me, it's just a more satisfying model. And the more I read about the history of science, the more I realize, like, you know, more convinced I've become that in a way, like, the whole fundamental epistemological assumptions of modern science just don't really stand up to any kind of careful criticism or scrutiny. And that's where I would say two things about your perspective. Is that it's interesting because you sort of turn it on its head and do embrace the mystical perspective. But the thing that I see in your work that I haven't seen in anybody else's, I've never read anybody who relates how human beings and the physical universe both relate to this idea of the zero point and a singularity at the root of all being. And that's a really profound understanding of things, different way of looking at things. You know, whether or not it's right, I mean, I think it is, but it's really quite brilliant.
It's a concept worthy of serious scientific personal investigation. Whether you want, like, I wouldn't encourage people to believe it. Like, I don't believe in believing. You know, I believe in having direct experiences of reality and trying to come closer to it through direct experience. So, as you're saying, like, I relate this idea of microcosm and macrocosm, the idea that they're based on the same principles of creation. So if we look at the creation of the universe, it kind of comes out of nothingness of the quantum vacuum. It has a first point singularity. It balloons into something, the world egg, and then it expands from within without, like the budding of a lotus. So that whole process that we can describe the universe growing like that, I'm saying a human being actually similarly grows in a similar analogous way, and that we similarly have a zero-point center, and that in a way we come out of nothingness. As a Sufi sage says, not since God brought man out of nothingness has he ceased to be a traveler. So the idea is that we are brought ourselves out of nothingness. Even though the nothingness isn't simply a nothingness, it's also a plenum, and it's a paradoxical realm. But it's a realm beyond manifest material existence.
Yeah, I would agree.
So I don't know. Do you know of any other consciousness researcher who suggests that conceives of consciousness as emerging from a point source, or as human beings as having a living zero point center? I don't know of anyone.
I don't. But and again, like I guess you know the couple of things, like you say. Like, you're not asking people to believe this, but the more, I think, you know, as you explore Blavatsky, it's interesting that really the full import of her work has not really been explored by, and she says in The Secret Doctrine, you know, that nothing sort of will happen for 100 years, that, you know, people will ignore her work. But, I mean, I see more and more the importance of really trying to examine her work in light of modern science, and trying to reach a greater synthesis, an integration of these ideas. And at the same time, it's true, like the whole esoteric and mystical tradition. I go back to this all the time, but you know, that book by Susan Blackmore, Conversations on Consciousness, where she gathers allegedly the, you know, top consciousness researchers in the world, and talks to them about the nature of consciousness. And, you know, these are really quite brilliant and accomplished people, many of them. But what strikes me is that on one level about almost everybody in that book is that they don't seem to have any awareness of this esoteric and mystical tradition and what it says about the nature of consciousness and the self. And it's sort of like, if you're going to pass yourself off as an expert on consciousness, you might want to take a look at these things, because these are quite profound ideas. And again, just because somebody says that, you know, that this is the way it is, doesn't mean that it's true. But the corollary to that is that you can't really claim an expertise when you've ignored an entire field of study, of which consists of thousands of years, and which really demands to be addressed on some level, and that's what I think is really quite galling about the whole contemporary scientific study of consciousness. It's so circumscribed and it's so arbitrary in its approach that it really doesn't get anywhere near, in my opinion, having studied consciousness for 30 years, I don't think it comes anywhere near addressing really the essential issues in consciousness.
No, I totally agree. And even those, most importantly, those things you can learn about consciousness through your own direct inner experience.
Yeah.
Like as more and more I've studied the concept of the heart doctrine, like what I teach, consciousness is connected to the heart, and it's connected to the blood flow in the body and the breath in the body, and how consciousness can be all through the body, versus the head doctrine, which is the belief that kind of consciousness is somehow produced up in the cerebral cortex, this kind of small area, cortical area, cortical areas on the cerebral cortex. And in a way, if you study yourself in your own inner experiences, I think it shows the obvious fallacy of that. It's completely inconsistent with numerous clinical observations one can make through one's own self-study. And it brings us back to what you were saying, Jim. It is like, here we have these esoteric traditions of, like, the yogis, saints, and masters, and so on, who have studied consciousness for centuries, directly through their own attempts to strive for self-perfection and awakening. So we should try to attend to what they teach us about the nature of consciousness and consider it seriously. Like, in a way, they've been the explorers of the inner cosmos, just like we as Western man kind of have explored the outer cosmos. They've been explorers of the inner cosmos. So we at least, their teachings deserve to be assessed or considered critically and scientifically. And that's what I attempt to do. I don't try to persuade people as a belief system to believe what I'm saying. I'm instead trying to say, consider this an alternative understanding. And it's very complicated, AJ. I mean, you just take the 30 years we've kind of studied and known each other through this process and all the kind of levels. Your book is going to be fascinating in terms of your giving a historic overview of how my work has changed from, you know, our early studies of the Gurdjieff-Uspensky teaching and then into the heart doctrine and spiritual views of consciousness, and then into creation physics, and now these kind of advanced metaphysical models.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been quite a story. I would never have believed it myself.
I see, too, like, I mean, it's quite an evolution, and it's quite a development, but I see at the same time, as you say, like, you know, it's very complex, and I wish that other people were aware of this alternative model, because I'm sure that there are people who have expertise in a variety of things, you know, biology, medicine, physics, chemistry, who would see things in this work and perhaps develop different areas of it and come to a realization of, you know, explanations of other things that remain mysterious or that kind of defy current description or interpretation, you know. And I just see it as it's a way of trying to reconceptualize things. Like, as you remember when we first started studying the Fourth Way and Gurdjieff and Uspensky, at the very least, like as we used to say, at the very least, when you take Gurdjieff's basic idea that our normal waking consciousness is illusory in a sense, it's a state of waking sleep and that we don't recognize this. If you take that basic idea and that consciousness has to be studied by studying yourself systematically, it's an invaluable heuristic for studying the whole contemporary scientific study of consciousness, because it really reveals all the assumptions that on which that approach is based, and it points out the limitations of the contemporary study of consciousness. And,
yeah.
and that, as I say, like these people who pass themselves off as experts, scientific experts on consciousness, when you read their conflicting interpretations and basic assumptions about things, you realize it's kind of a confusion of tongues, and that at the very least, that if they would study this history of the science of being, of the internal cosmos, as you say, they would have a much, much, I think, more comprehensive and precise understanding of what the nature of the questions are about consciousness. Like, I see, like, that really consciousness has really been a hot topic in psychology over the last 30 years, but in some ways, like, there are some interesting discoveries, but it doesn't seem to be proceeding anywhere. Like, it's going around in circles, and you know, people can't even sort of agree on what the basic facts are or the basic assumptions, you know, and there's just so much wrong thinking about it. And at the very least, I think that the esoteric and mystical tradition really clarifies a lot of those issues and puts it on a completely different basis.
Yeah, it really does. And as you say, it's a perspective that which once you begin to grasp it, it has potential application in all these different areas of science.
Right.
Like, I know as I've learned this perspective, I have so many questions now I would be interested in talking to cardiologists about.
Hmm.
Neuroscientists about. You know, it has application in the study. In my new book on the secret doctrine and science, I provide a whole new way of trying to understand the enigmas of dark energy and dark matter and what these might be and how mistaken our other concepts are. Like, it gives you a perspective that allows you a wholly alternative viewpoint from which to critique existent kind of zeitgeist, like the existent paradigm.
Right.
Like, I think one of the things that most led me to understand that was, like, learning through mystical studies to think in numbers. I remember writing about using that phrase years ago, because how in mystical teachings, the idea is that there, a divine mystery teaching is that the one becomes three and manifests as seven. So we have the tree of life in Kabbalah with three supernal spheres and seven spheres below. So there's a supernal triad and creates seven realms below. Now, this basic concept of the one divided by three to yield seven. So that's kind of a number geometric sequencing in that. Now, if we take that kind of thinking and then turn to modern psychology and science, I see everybody in the mainstream thinks dualistically. So psychologists think there's a body and the mind, left brain, right brain, conscious, unconscious, stimulus response, and the physicists think there's matter and energy in time and space, waves and particles, observers observed. They think dualistically all the time. So if I were to compare mystical teachings with modern science, here's an example. The modern scientist thinks that, oh, the world is composed of matter and energy, whereas from a mystical perspective, I would say, no, there's a triunity of matter, energy, and intelligence, and these exist upon seven different dimensions within the universe. So I would have a model of these triune forces on seven dimensions. Okay, whereas all the modern scientists, they just have matter and energy, waves and particles. It's simplistic. It's in its dualistic nature. Even in modern physics, it's now emerging in new quantum theory and information theory in physics. Physicists now recognize information as third force in science. So science itself is coming more to the mystical view of that there's information or intelligence latent within space itself, within the medium within which we live and move and have our being. So I'm suggesting we as human beings have these deep zero-point centers which exist in a way in these higher dimensional spaces, and that there's these higher intelligences manifest from within without from zero-point sources. But there's many examples like this where if you begin to see how dualistic modern thinking is, then you begin to realize, wow, these laws of three and seven are very, very curious and deserve to be considered. I mean, how long have we tried to understand these principles, Jim?
Yeah.
30 years, eh?
Yeah.
Because we learned it, I would say, from the Gurdjieff teaching, where Gurdjieff calls it the two fundamental cosmic laws, the law of three and the law of seven. But then I found out later, well, the laws of three and seven are also hidden in Kabbalah, in Judaism, in Sufism, in the Dalai Lama's teachings, and in all these esoteric teachings. They all embody that idea of the laws of three and seven. So let's take this as a model of creation and consider it seriously as an idea that nature embodies these principles. It's like the old Pythagorean idea, God geometizes in all the manifestations of nature. There's an inherent geometry as things are generated from within without, out of no number. Blavatsky says how number is generated out of no number. So it kind of begins with a zero, and then you have a one, which is that first point, and then there's a triunity of forces, and then it produces a seven. So this whole concept of those principles, I mean, that's pretty astonishing and has most interesting applications, particularly in physics. That's where I have most studied the application of these ideas. But you can see it in all other areas as well, eh, Jim? The value of these basic concepts in approaching any area of science.
Well, if you think of it in terms of yogic teaching, you know, you have one, which is prana, which is the basic life force, and then you have three channels in the human body, the Ida, the Pingala, and the Sushumna, is that right?
Yes.
And then you have the seven chakras. So
yeah.
You have one, you have a fundamental life force field, which enters the body through these three channels and is distributed through the seven vortices of the energy centers of the chakras. You know, I mean, it's perfectly consistent with the idea that, you know, the esoteric maxim that God is first one, then three, then seven. You know, and
yeah.
You see it repeatedly. I mean, it's in various traditions. You know, I mean, really, okay, you're talking about, you know, that physicists now are understanding. And, you know, that rather than just matter and energy, it should be matter, energy, and information, that there's the third force. Well, you know, that's been in mystical and esoteric thought. I mean, the three gunas, how old are those? About 4,000 to 5,000 years? I mean, nobody really knows.
Thousands
of years old.
Pre-Christian.
I mean, this would be people saying something really astonishing about the nature of the universe, about the nature of creation. And that I mean, even there, like that, you know, talk about intelligent design. Like, people don't see that. Like, the law of three and the law of seven, that you know, that's intelligent design. I mean, that's certainly a schema worth looking at. I mean, when I first started reading the Fourth Way, I found, like, the idea of the fundamental cosmic laws is kind of a little bit, like, well, I found it very strange, and it was kind of contrary to my scientific training, quote-unquote. And, you know, it was when I first started to really see the value of, like, the law of three was when you formulated it in terms of the psychological, how in psychology everybody saw things dualistically in terms of there was this and then there was that. And people would identify some concept and then just automatically assign everything else to its opposite. You know, that it, as Gurdjieff said, it's the most mechanical type of thinking is to think in twos. And
simplistic.
I see that, and people all through modern theory, you know, they identify one thing, and then everything that's left over becomes the other thing. It's like the left brain, right brain.
Yeah,
you know,
science and religion.
Well,
the left brain,
it's a religion. The left brain, right brain was really interesting because, I mean, here we had these kind of interesting discoveries about some sort of differentiation of function in the brain occurs, and that the left brain seems to operate in certain ways, and then the right brain seems to operate in certain ways. But then all of a sudden, it's like every possible human attribute had to be assigned to either one of these hemispheres or the other. And, you know, it was like,
I remember reading Ornstein in The Psychology of Consciousness. He ends up putting the heart in the left hemisphere because he's like, he aligns all the dualities, and everybody thinks all the dualities have to do with the left and the right side of the brain. It was so funny.
Yeah, and then Kinsborn
called it dichotomania.
Yeah.
Seeing everything dualistically and then thinking all your dualities are the same.
Yeah.
I mean, he put the conscious in the left hemisphere and the unconscious in the right, and reason and passion, and it's all in the head. I mean, even in Gurdjieff talks about two forms of thinking. He talks about mentation by thought and mentation by form. So mentation by thought is more left brain. It's more linear, sequential, reason-based. And mentation by form is more dealing with gestalts, wholes. So that can be in the right brain. Like, often dualistic distinctions are important. It's what you don't want to do, though, is think that then you want to see what the third element is that is not just the two, but there's that which synthesizes them and brings them together and is something in addition to either of the opposites.
Yeah.
I remember David Bohm describing the nature of an electron, and he said, well, it's a wave and a particle and something in between.
Yeah.
So it is like there's this threefoldness to it. And often we see the dual aspects to things, but the third force is always hidden there. There's some third force that we need to seek out.
Yeah, like Gurdjieff says, we're third force blind in our normal consciousness, and that sometimes the third force is the medium itself. It's implicit in the medium itself, or sometimes it's hidden from us in our normal consciousness, but that's what we have to do, is to go beyond. And that's why it's so much... thinking and conceptualizing is really superficial in that sense, because it doesn't go beyond the obvious two elements to create the third element or to recognize it.
It's like another false dichotomy. Well, two of them I'd like to mention. One is The whole of psychology today is defined as the science of behavior and the mind. So you have a body and the mind in the brain. Whereas Gurdjieff says, well, no, we really have seven minds, seven centers. You know, so it's a much more complicated, and all mind isn't up in the head. Like, the head is the center of one mind, but then you have your instinctual brain and your emotional brain. It's like everything isn't just up in the head. A human being has a much more subtle seven levels to mind, seven. And in psychology, the most important triunity, I think, is this basic idea that human beings function mentally, emotionally, and physically. That we don't just function mentally and physically, but it's mentally, emotionally, and physically. Head, heart, hands. Gurdjieff says we have three stories. The intellectual center is centered in the mind, in the head, in the upper story, and then the central story is the heart and the emotional center connected to the center of the chest. And then the lower story is the lower story, including the instinctual centers in the stomach and the sexual nature, the material nature. So this idea we function mentally, emotionally, and physically, whereas all of modern psychology, there was only the mind and the body, and everyone wonders, how do we put them back together again?
Yeah, I think that, you know, getting back to something we were talking about earlier is that, you know, just when I first began to study the fourth way and just started to question the nature of consciousness, this idea that we could be centered, that our consciousness could be centered in different parts of our body, like when we're thinking and reasoning or thinking of something abstractly, we're sort of in our heads. But then if we're doing a physical activity like sports or some sort of physical exertion, we're more physically centered in our bodies. And then other times we can be more physically are more centered in our hearts and in our emotional centers, and that really that in order to understand the nature of our experience, there's this constant interaction between our intellectual, emotional, and physical centers, and that really when you start to observe this in yourself, you see how intimately they're connected, how, like, you know, you have a thought and it starts a current of emotion, which on some level is translated into your physical presence, you know, and vice versa. Like they're so intimately connected.
Yeah, interaction between these different centers.
Yeah, yeah. There's this communication going on all the time between, so that in a way it's like it's much more complex, even in the taking people as three brain beings.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, it kind of shows, I think, really what the big problem with most of modern psychotherapy is that it doesn't recognize the complexity of trying to change I'd say that psychotherapy tries to change people, whereas mystical and esoteric teachings try to transform people, and that if you really want to develop the self and consciousness, you realize that there are such incredible obstacles to that because of the interaction and the subtlety of the connections between your intellect, your heart, and your physical body. So that's why people need teachers, is because we don't have the capacity to kind of keep watch over ourselves all the time. That, you know, we're so embedded or absorbed in our habitual and unconscious activities that it's very difficult for us to awaken to them and identify them so that we can change them.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's inner separation of beginning to study yourself. Like, as Gurdjieff says, to study yourself, you need a bit of a system. You can't just go about it willy-nilly any little old way and expect to achieve results. Because, yeah, you need a system. And in a way, that's why we turn to esoteric teachings, because these people are people who've attained something in their development. So they're trying to provide us insights on the path to help us attain some realizations.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, too. I mean, another aspect of this is that when I started to study myself systematically and to create that inner separation, you realize, in a way, like it really casts a new light on what we mean when we say I.
Yeah.
You see that what esoteric teachings do is that you see that something that you think you understand has so many different levels to it and has all these interior dimensions to it. And it's like, it reminds me kind of like when Carl Sagan says, when he talked to people about God, and he questioned them, well, what do you mean by God? And people would say, well, you know, God. And then he said, well, no, I don't. What exactly do you mean by God? And as he points out, I mean, I think this is quite right. He says, well, people mean very different things when they say God. Some people think God is like a patriarch with a long beard sitting up in heaven, you know, looking down on us all.
Counting
sparrows and telling morning glories to open. And some people think God is just another name for all of nature's laws. But when let's turn that around and look at I, you know, well, you know, I, you know, or what you mean by I, but I mean, that's the interesting thing is that, like in that book on the Conversations on Consciousness, it's interesting how nobody kind of questions their I experience in that book.
Yeah.
Nobody kind of questions the nature of I. What is the nature of I or the self? And that's what the mystical perspective provides, is that you see it's multidimensional, and that it's not the first thing to recognize is it's not what you think it is, that we walk around with illusions of I, which are completely out of contact with the nature of reality, and that by studying yourself and trying to awaken I, you can transform your understanding of the nature of that experience, and it's not at all what you think it is. And I'd say that's something that's just completely missing from contemporary approaches to the study of psychology and consciousness, is that nobody really recognizes the depth of I. And that's one thing about your work which is really interesting, because you're saying I isn't this bundle of neurons in your brain, you know, I is centered within a point in your heart which is connected to the metaphysical and higher dimensional nature of reality, and that on some level, individual I is related to the I of the cosmos, is related to the unity of creation, which is, such a profound it's such a profound challenge to kind of our understanding of everything. But in a way, like, the more I read it and study this, the more it just makes complete sense to me, you know. Maybe there's something I'm missing, but it seems to be quite rational and lucid and logical that it fits with both modern scientific conceptualizations of physics and with ancient ideas of metaphysics and with spiritual teachings that it's there. You have to kind of mine it out and refine it to see it. But I think it really exists.
Yeah, once you begin to grasp it, it's amazing, because it's like learning the keys to certain other sacred literature. Like, if you have the concept of the heart doctrine, then reread your Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah.
And you'll see, oh, the Lord Krishna says, I am the self seated in the hearts of all beings. You know, and then he explains that both the super soul is connected to the heart, and the individual soul, the jiva atma, the individual self. So he describes one as infinite, the other is infinitesimal. So you find it there, or you read the Sufi masters, and they talk about the divine spark within the heart.
Yeah.
You know, or you read Kabbalah, and you see how the line of light comes down from Keter, which is a point source, to dot into the heart in Tiferet. So in Kabbalah and Judaism, you find the same concept, that the God principle is within the human heart. In Kabbalah, it said the name of God is inscribed within the human heart. So all these teachings suggest that there is a serious higher dimensional physics to the human heart. And these concepts, as you begin to understand them, it allows you to explain all these enigmatic phenomena which otherwise are inexplicable and which are ignored by those people who pretend to be the scientists. They're the scientists who put blindfolders on and only can see what falls into their paradigm. So what we want to do is take off those blinders a bit and it's a new way of understanding creation and trying to understand creation. And it's a new way of assessing different knowledge you read within science itself. It's absolutely fascinating. I found having a mystical perspective in life has made learning about any other kind of phenomena, it gives you a whole new perspective on it. Hey, Jim, haven't you found that? Like, I'm interested in the physiology of the heart and the blood and the nature of the sun and the, you know, all these things. You have a different perspective on what these different areas of study might mean and how they're related. Whereas other scientists are all what I call little bit scientists. Everybody becomes a specialist on some little quirk or quark of the human psyche or chemistry or information theory or something. Everyone's a little specialist in a little bit. And you have all these little bit scientists. But really, to understand, I remember Uspensky saying, to understand any part ultimately implicates the whole. And I think I remember in his book, collection of papers he had, where he says, like, just consider if I took this ashtray, he says, and okay, like, what if, how could I, what would it involve to know what this ashtray, I have an ashtray in front of me here, what does it mean to know this ashtray? Well, firstly, to know that ashtray, well, I'd have to know, well, it's composed of certain types of particles, you know, the substances it's made of, and where did those come from? Well, that would be traced back to supernova explosions and beyond that to the Big Bang. So the ashtray, ultimately, if you traced it back, would go back to the singularity. And then to know what the ashtray is, well, it's an ashtray in a particular place and space and time. So it's my ashtray. So you have to understand it in relationship to who I am in this space and time in my life and human history. And so it's like if you took anything, and to understand any element, to ultimately understand it, it kind of grows into having to understand the whole. I remember Gurdjieff talking about, he's saying, to understand the part, you have to understand the whole. But to understand the whole, you have to understand the parts. So it's like we kind of need to go a bit of both together, trying to understand the relationship of parts to the wholes.
Yeah, he said that, you know, about his teaching that you had to understand anything, you had to understand everything, you know, which in a way it sounds ridiculous, but of course, it allows for different levels of knowing everything and knowing something, and that's, to me, that's what's so fascinating about that particular teaching, is that having studied it for 30 years, it's a progressive kind of spiral of reintegration and I've never reached the point at any point, and you know, as a professional naysayer, as an intellectual, I've never reached any point where I thought, well, this just isn't explicable in terms of this teaching, or this is wrong. You know, I think precisely the opposite. I'll admit that there are parts of it that I don't know and that I don't understand, but it seems to me that always involves this progressive integration of more and more material, and I see more and more how the parts fit the whole. And I mean, I'd say that's true of your model of consciousness and the universe, is that I progressively reintegrate it, and I see it more and more clearly. The other side to what you were saying, too, about how, like, you know, everything's interesting, and you see it in a different perspective when you, adopt a mystical and esoteric perspective on things, is that I see, like Gurdjieff said, one of the aspects of formatory thinking is that one of the phrases by which it's identified is that something is nothing but, is the attempt to reduce everything to understood categories and not to question anything. And I see that on all levels in different areas of expertise and commentary and just in talking with people, is how frequently people are deluded by saying, well, that's just this, or it's nothing but that.
Yeah.
Or that, you know, they have these preformed conceptualizations, and that they think that they understand things. And, coming to it from a different perspective, I would, you know, it would take me hours, to, if not months or years, to sit down and argue with people that, you know, well, this is really quite questionable what you're saying, you know. So I usually don't say anything, but I see it more and more. It's like, remember years ago, there was that program you used to refer to this. There was a program in the 70s on TV, and they interviewed little kids, and they would ask them questions, and then these kids would start to talk, and they'd answer these questions. And they never knew what, anything that they were talking about. They just kind of made these ridiculous stories up, and, you know, like as kids do, well, this is this, and, you know, and this is because of this. And really, that's what a lot of what passes as informed commentary reminds me of, is that it's just people babbling, you know. They don't
it's
really know.
It's kind of just
these,
what you're told, or what, you know, what the media, how they condition your mind and lead you on to believe all these.
It's just your left brain operating. I was like, well, you don't know that, you know. It's like, I mean, you don't even know that that's in your brain, let alone that it's your left brain. You know, it's like you could question people on so many comments that they make about things and explanations of things. And I see that's the danger in a sense of in modern times. I think that, you know, that with the rise of science, and it's sort of the imperialism of modern scientific thinking and the scientism of materialism and reductionism, is that these people, many scientists who subscribe to these views have such kind of dismissive attitudes towards a whole range of matters which really lie outside of their areas of expertise, but they're quite convinced that there's nothing to them. And, that I think that's quite dangerous, that it's what, you know, William Blake talked about, single vision. I think that we have single vision in our culture in many ways, that everything's materialistic and mechanistic.
It's funny now because I have a different perspective on it in a way now than previously also, in that now I think that kind of materialist philosophy, nothing but ism, and the naysaying and pseudo-scientific skeptics things, I think that's been an intentionally done dummy down the human psyche thing. And that really that the people who are knowledgeable and the elites and so on are very interested in the occult and always have been. But they've tapped it for evil purposes. So I think in a way that is that version of dummied down mankind and all the lies. That's what you get, the educational system, to keep people asleep. That's what you get in your religion. Yeah. But I think there are other circles where people comprehend more of this and are knowledgeable about it. I mean, who was it in the States who funded the research into paranormal abilities and so on? It was the CIA and other groups like that, like in the intelligence community. So I do think there are groups who have a far more advanced knowledge of this, but in a way have wanted to dummy down the educational system for their devious purposes.
Well, I'm not saying that that's not possible, but I don't think that's true. I mean, I think it's much less intentional and much less directed. I just think that they're very important historical forces that have led people. And I say that they were political forces, but not in the way that you mean it. Like, I mean, I think that changes have occurred and have reinforced this secularization and the rise of the ascendancy of materialist science, but I don't think that they're as conscious or directed as you're suggesting. I mean, not that within that there haven't been people who have definitely tried to exploit things and have definitely tried to shape things in certain ways. I wouldn't deny that either. So it's a complicated question.
It is, as to how things have
come to this. But
I see almost like multi-dimensional beings which can possess people through space.
Wow.
And feed off their souls. And that vacates those people, so they become what Gurdjieff calls terrestrial nullities. They lose their souls. And
certainly, lots of evidence for the existence of such nullities.
Yeah,
I'd say there's overwhelming evidence for that. I love that phrase, actually, too.
Isn't that a beautiful phrase? Terrestrial nullities.
Yeah,
kind of beings who are empty.
Yeah.
Like empty is not having any heart.
Yeah.
That's how I see it now.
Yeah, no, like that's
you know,
good.
It's like they say, most human beings are ruled by the three lower chakras, money, sex, and power.
Yeah.
And in a way, they would do anything to pursue their own kind of self-satisfaction and money, sex, and power, no matter what kind of suffering they would cause to anybody. They're like control freaks who want to rule the world, you know, have everybody with a microchip in and...
You know,
treat everyone like a little rat, you know.
It always
they're so afraid of freedom and have so their terrestrial nullities that try to acquire inner being existence by having this kind of pathological control freak nature.
I think
quite
that,
remarkable.
Yeah, I think when you say that, I'm always reminded of that film Chinatown, in which the guy is, Noah Cross is manipulating the flow of water and you know, he's buying up land in the San Fernando Valley and he's going to irrigate it and turn it into, you know, this incredibly rich land. But in the meantime, he's manipulating all this, and then the Jack Nicholson character confronts him and he says, you know, how much are you worth? And he said, oh, I don't know, you know. And he said, millions? Oh, he said, far more than that. He said, oh, but he doesn't really know how wealthy he is, but he's fabulously wealthy. And he said, why are you doing this, you know? And
like what is it you want?
Yeah, and he says it's the future, you know. And it's like the ultimate control freak. He wants to control time. You know, I mean, he's going to be dead. He's an older man already, but it's like he's so pathological that he can't really answer the question, you know, in a sense. And I look at, you know, what people are willing to do in terms of political leaders and business leaders in terms of the suffering that they willfully, impose upon people. And you think, like, what kind of... How do those people sleep at night, you know? What exactly is the nature? What is wrong with these people that they're so twisted and deformed that they can actually live with themselves and conduct themselves in this way? Like, I mean, you know, it...
Yeah, what is that?
Especially...
How is it conceivable? To most normal people, to me, it was inconceivable, kind of.
Yeah.
That people would be like that, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm used to being relatively... poor and I have the power over no one.
Yeah.
I don't even want power over people.
And it's like these inconsistencies too, you know, that you know, it's like the German hierarchy during the Second World War and, you know, during the Holocaust, you know, like the good commandant of a concentration camp, you know, and go and have a nice dinner with his wife and children and, you know, pet his dog and behave like a normal human being, so-called, and yet, you know, be overseeing the extermination of hundreds of thousands of people. It's just like it's you know, Hitler was a vegetarian, you know.
Really?
Yeah, he you know, he didn't object to killing millions of people, but he didn't want to eat meat, you know. I was like, and he loved his dog. I mean, it's like on some level you kind
of
think,
it's horrifying.
What kind of dissociation in terms of their psyche is going on there? And I mean, that's the way I look at when I listen to these people rationalize this, just this unbelievable destruction that they've loosed on other people, and their willingness just to murder people for power, you know, and to impose this like incredible hardship on them, you know, for what? You know, so they're already wealthy. They already have power, but they want more. And you think, good Lord, you know, what the hell's the matter with people? You know, like, it's very disturbing when you sort of step back. And it's like, you know, in Gurdjieff's book, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, you know, it's like, I think that's one thing that's really kind of useful and has developed over the years, and I think you have the same thing, but for me, it's like, at times I look at human beings now, like from the perspective of, like, an extraterrestrial intelligence, I sort of look down on us and think, you know, boy, are they ever peculiar.
Some perspective on
the three-brain beings of the planet Earth are certainly very strange beings, you know. And of course, I include myself in that, but it's useful to kind of step outside of all everything. It's, you know, like, Gurdjieff's intention was to corrode without mercy all the rubbish accumulated in human mentation, you know?
Yeah, through the centuries. Corrode without mercy all the rubbish.
Yeah.
All the wrong ideas, wrong understanding.
Yeah, and
it's interesting you mentioned Beelzebub, because I had one particular bit of my writing that I wanted to go into today, which was from my book Psychological Illusions, and it's Gurdjieff, and the chapter is called Lunatics, Tramps, and Husnamus Individuals. And in Beelzebub's tales, Gurdjieff has this kind of category of human beings, and he calls them Husnamus. I don't know even if I'm pronouncing it correctly. But I had here his basic descriptions of Husnamus individuals. You want to hear that?
Yes, sure,
that
yeah. Means?
Okay. According to Beelzebub, like who Gurdjieff is writing in the words of Beelzebub, the term Husnamus refers to people who, quote, for some reason, data have not been crystallized for the divine impulse of objective conscience. So it's like they don't have that divine impulse of objective conscience within
wow.
themselves.
Wow.
So they, like Gurdjieff sees the remorse of conscience as like the path to awakening. You have to have that like capacity for the remorse of conscience.
Wow.
And these people, for some reason, that impulse of conscience is missing in them. And then listen to this. Beelzebub describes then seven, now this is a funny term, Naluosnian spectrum of impulses. Okay, so he's going to describe seven being impulses that these kind of Husnamus individuals have, are the primary features of such people. These include, and then these are Gurdjieff's list, every kind of depravity, conscious as well as unconscious. Okay, number two, the feeling of self-satisfaction from leading others astray.
Like, can you think, oh, yeah, CNN, yeah, thanks, guys, you know, you're the most truthful in news, and you can show me all these little hoaxy things you do to scare people. Okay, feeling of self-satisfaction from leading others astray. Okay, number three,
the irresistible inclination to destroy the existence of other breathing creatures.
Wow.
Hey, isn't that something, eh?
Yeah.
Irresistible inclination to destroy the existence of other breathing creatures.
Yeah.
Wow, that's so heavy. I have to move on. The urge to become free from the necessity of actualizing the being efforts demanded by nature.
Mm.
Okay, so free from having to actualize being efforts demanded by nature. So I guess, okay. Number five, the attempt by every kind of artificiality to conceal from others what, in their opinion, are one's physical defects.
Hmm.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like striving for that kind of outer, you know, they all got the whitest teeth on TV, you know? They all got such nice clothes and white teeth, you know, I got my stained teeth and old clothes. I just, you know, and then they are, it's like so artificial, but it's all like that image and you know, and it's like, what's Eliot's line, T.S. Eliot in The Wasteland, kind of like between the reality and the
shadow.
Between
the reality and the act falls the shadow. Yeah.
Between, like what's the real and what's the reality,
exactly.
You know, falls the shadow. Like Okay, so that's, so that was to attempt by every kind of artificiality to conceal from others what, in their opinion, are one's physical defects. Okay, the next, the calm self-contentment in the use of what is not personally deserved. And then number seven, the striving to be not what one is.
Wow.
Wow, heavy, eh?
Well, yeah.
So Hasnamas individuals, and he says like some Hasnamas. Okay, I'll read a bit of my writing here. I haven't read this for years. Certainly, here's from Psychological Illusions. Certainly, Beelzebub outlines a charming list of characteristics. Such impulses are formed within the crystallized egoism so prominent among the common psyches of those three brain beings on planet Earth. The Hasnamas individual no longer experiences the impulses of being self-shame. Gurdjieff uses that, being self-shame. And the history of humanity, I write, testifies to the horrors caused by these terrestrial nullities. Again, Gurdjieff's term. Beelzebub uses the term Hasnamas to refer in a negative way to certain classes of people whose actions, manifestations, and impulses represent the worst psychopathology of humankind and who cause the worst sufferings, falsity, and misunderstanding among the three brain beings on Earth. A certain definite, quote, something has become formed or crystallized in an individual as a relatively fixed characterological complex which dominates their common presence. The fact that data for the divine impulse of objective conscience are not crystallized in them suggests that a false consciousness system is in full sway and the real consciousness has passed into the subconscious. Such individuals will be primarily egoistically and care little how much suffering and misfortune they cause others. Hasnamas individuals may refer to those consisting of only a planetary body, but includes those who have at least partially coded the higher being bodies. At a later point, we will consider four types of Hasnamas individuals described by Beelzebub and their afterlife fates, where they face, quote, serious retributive suffering consequences. The Hasnamas individuals have the most disturbed and crystallized forms of false personality, and human history is littered with their names. So that's a little bit of writing back from Psychological Illusions on Hasnamas individuals. What kind of a horrifying boy. The irresistible inclination to destroy the existence of other breathing creatures. Oh,
yeah.
No.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. And the one irresistible, oh, no, the feeling of self-satisfaction from leading others astray.
Yeah.
Wow. Everybody, that should be the underlying motto under all the news shows.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think generally they name an airport or, build a statue to people like that, you know. That's like...
Yeah, that is a remarkable book, Beelzebub's Tales. I so want to get back and reread that and expand my book, The Slugs, on Beelzebub's Tales.
It would be interesting for it to, see what you make of it now in terms of your understanding of Blavatsky too, eh?
Yeah, exactly.
I remember reading this Romanian physicist, he's in one of those collections of papers on Gurdjieff, and I think his name is Niscarascu, and he was talking about Jacob Bohm's cosmology and how, the parallels between that and Gurdjieff's cosmology also, and it's interesting, like, again, the more you learn of these different mystical and esoteric doctrines, the more you kind of, the greater depth you get when you read these different people and different perspectives, eh? Because there's so many aspects of these things that you can understand them on a certain level, but the more you know, obviously, the better your interpretation and the deeper it is, the more profound it is. But on just on an emotional level, like, that's just an incredible description of
the Hasnamas.
These individuals. Well, I started to laugh because I was thinking he also has some sort of characterization in there about seven qualities of writers, and there's something about like that he when somebody becomes a writer is that they walk around with their noses in the air and they have opinions and attitudes and beliefs on everything and think that everybody should listen to them. And the last one is that they develop something called hemorrhoids, which is the only thing that they carry with any modesty. It's quite a hilarious book. I mean, it's so shocking on so many levels, and it's so disturbing. But on another level, it's so hilarious too. Like when he's challenging people's understanding of things that normal understanding of things is just it's very funny. It's funny that we came to that because I didn't know that you wanted to read that quote. And yet we came around to it anyway.
Well, our guest didn't show up, and I'm not really sure why and what's involved there.
Is it a timing issue?
But I had it because it related to what I thought this woman was talking about and such. But in a way, sometimes it's nice not to be into the political aspect so much of the show, and I find that in my own life, in a way, at times it's just so overwhelming dealing with the monstrosity of it all. Last night I watched on YouTube was Zeitgeist. Watch that movie. It's an hour and 50 minutes or something. Absolutely shocking movie.
Really? I
strongly recommend that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also people, I would strongly recommend people watch the video by Black Eyed Peas of the song "Where Is the Love," and just look at that and watch that, and kind of awaken in your conscience. Let's kind of wake up here and look what's happening in the world, and seeing the unnecessary suffering and tragedies of humankind. Is it Albert Einstein who has that quotation, like the evil that happens isn't just simply due to some evil people, but so much as to do to the inactions of, good people, I forget that quote.
Well, I think that there's a quote that at Robert Kennedy's funeral that his brother quoted him as saying something about that evil or bad things happen to us in essence because, not because of what bad people did, but what good people failed to do.
Oh, you would not believe the quotation in the movie I just mentioned, Zeitgeist.
Yeah.
You wouldn't believe the quotation in that movie from John Kennedy before he was assassinated, warning humankind as to the dark element that he had found within the government and such. You wouldn't believe the quotation.
Well, there's a lot of good quotations out there. I mean, Dwight Eisenhower, basically said it when a military man warning us about